I learned a lot very early, which fast-tracked my career. So I was involved in a turnaround very young, and we had HMRC knock on the door saying, we're about to close the business, found we've gone MIA. We were in meltdown. How to turn a business from red to black. I started a direct-to-consumer cocktail business, bootstrapped. I'll never do it again. My health has suffered immeasurably. It's my job now to help give people perspective. Hey, when you're in the trenches, you think every decision you make is such an important decision. The reality is, only 1 in 100 decisions you're making is actually a business quick decision. But the key thing is, keep making decisions and moving forward. There are a couple of VCs that sit on these very early stage boards and have too much of a say. Almost, they're actually making the wrong decisions for founders because they've never even been a founder themselves, but the founder feel obliged to listen to this. Get people from different backgrounds, people that you trust and have a vested interest in the business being successful. We would like to help and support as many founders as we possibly can.
I'm so excited to interview my next guest, Richard Hadler, angel investor in 20 companies, including Odin, Space Goods, and Freya. He's also got 3 exits under his belt, is the founder of Founders Capital, and is the author of Marketing the Bottom Line. Rich, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So first off, you look way too young to have achieved everything that you have. What's your secret? Do you just like sip the elixir of youth, or... have you got more hours in the day than the rest of us? What's the secret?
You should have seen me 5 years ago. I don't feel it, I must say. I don't know. I've always been quite young. I think, you know, I've always entered rooms and people have this kind of like almost feeling that I won't actually know what I'm talking about. And yeah. I think that actually it's always played to my advantage.
I was just going to say that you can play that to your advantage, can you? Because people just underestimate you.
A little bit, yeah.
So can you give us the overview of your story? Like, obviously I gave a quick intro there at the start. You're angel investor now, you've got Founders Capital. You were telling me earlier about all these other exciting ventures, but rewind us a little bit, like how, like overview of sort of how you got to where you are now.
Yeah, well, So I skipped uni. I was working full time from a very young age.
Did you ever start uni or just skipped it?
Completely? I did a day.
You did a day.
So I'd been working full time for the 2 years prior to that.
And
when I say full time, doing my A levels, I was working full time to such an extent where the school took me aside and said, "Your attendance is in the toilet," and I was a bit cocky and said, don't worry about it, you know, I'm going to get good grades. I was doing business anyway and I was learning a lot more on the job. That's the way I saw it.
How come you were working full-time? Did you need to?
I didn't need to, but I loved it. So I was working in a holiday park in the New Forest called Sandy Balls, for those that might know it. In fact, I was the recipient of a call that got live streamed on the Jonathan Ross show when someone prank called Sandy Balls.
That's Google. Hilarious.
So I was working full time and I started uni and I was in the tutor group first day, whatever. And so they said something about it being a full time course. And I put my hand up and went, just so you're aware, I'm only going to be here sporadically. And they went, what do you mean? And I was like, well, I've got a full-time job. And I was like, don't worry about it. I did it. My A-level was all good. And they were like, no, this is a full-time course. You can't do a full-time job and a full-time course. And I was like, yes, I can. Anyway, I went back to my MD at the time and said to him, slight complication, which is, you know, I'm, you know, they actually want me to be in, funnily enough. And he said, well, it's up to you. But he advised me against doing it, which was... at the time, some people could construe as not great advice. But what actually then unfolded is I actually didn't go to uni, but then I did an OU degree that was paid for by the business. So I got the best of both worlds. But yes, but the point is I learned a lot very early, which fast-tracked my career.
So like classic entrepreneur, like never really went to school, like skipped out, just like wanted to get your hands dirty, get stuck into business.
I hated school.
Yeah. Okay.
I liked a lot of it, but I didn't really, and I wasn't bad at it, I would say, but I definitely didn't, I wasn't enthused by it at all.
There's been an interesting pattern on the show with some guests who either fall into that same camp as yours and others who, more like me, to be honest, who did like school, I was good at it, I was a classic, like, straight A, teacher's pet, Hermione Granger, like, you name it, and that doesn't set you up for success whatsoever in the real world, and even less so in entrepreneurship, because you're like, give me the textbook, I can study something, I learn the exact, you know, do a mock test, and but you don't
EQ,
you don't
IQ.
Have that in the real world.
EQ, IQ, yeah.
Right?
Well, you don't, but I think, you know, you have to have a level of proficiency, you know, and certain jobs require you to have a, you know, a very significant understanding about certain subject matters. It just so happened that I always had my heart set on being a business person, and I felt like I could learn more in the work environment than I could.
And when you say you always had your heart set on that, did you have role models growing up? Did you look at other more famous people? Was anyone in your family an entrepreneur? What kind of sowed that seed for you?
Yeah, I mean, my parents were quite, I mean, they worked a lot. and I always used to, you know, even at a young age, apart from a few months of wanting to be an optician and then seeing behind an eye and then not wanting to be an optician, I always wanted to work in the city wearing a suit. It was weird. And now, you know, we work in the city, but we definitely don't wear suits. But yeah, I always had this thought in my mind that, you know, I'd be in a job. I didn't even know what the job would be, but it would be in the city.
Mm, okay, interesting. All right, so let's fast forward a little bit. Yeah. So I know that you founded your own businesses. Yeah. I mentioned at the start, you got, is it three exits under your belt? Fact check, is that true?
Yeah, three exits, varying degrees of success.
Right.
But no failures.
So let's go there, because anyone I've had on the show so far who's had an exit, they've got a story to share.
Yeah,
you mentioned Nick Telson Sillett before, was on the show, the craziest exit day in history. Yeah. With his story, it was just giving me palpitations listening to it. What were your exit days like? Were they anywhere near as dramatic, or what happened with you?
No, not really, to be honest with you. Like, certainly in my world, I was working up to an exit for a couple of years, like doing an earnout, hitting the right numbers. You know, you've been in the marketing world. Running an agency, you're running a service-based business, and there are certain ways to exit service-based businesses versus product businesses. So, nothing like Nick's story, but, you know, there's certainly leading up to those periods, you have to hit the right notes to, you know, achieve what you need to achieve from a financial perspective. But, I think they've all been different, I would say. I mean, there are stories. So I was involved in a turnaround very young.
How old?
20. I had a business where I was an employee in that business and very one of the first few employees. And we had HMRC knock on the door saying, we're about to close the business. I realised we were in financial ruin. The founder had gone MIA. I'm not going to talk about it too much. But it was, we were in meltdown. And I was thrust into a position very young where we had to turn around this business from a very difficult position to a very positive one in a short period of time. And I think that set it definitely helped me grow up very quickly.
Wow.
And I got a lot of experience very young about, you know, how to turn a business from red to black and everything that comes alongside that, and managing people and, you know, juggling, you know, multiple things and you know, working in 15 different roles and, you know, how to read a P&L. I've always run businesses where I manage a P&L.
Yeah.
You know, wow. So ironically, I'm an angel investor now, and we've invested in some fantastic founders who, you know, a lot of them are VC-backed. Ironically, I've never been in the position where, you know, I've had a lot of cash behind us where we can have a large burn. I've always needed to make sure the businesses that I've run have made profit, whether that be the agencies that were, you know, service-based businesses, and we had large headcount, which meant, you know, we had a lot of mouths to feed, and then we need to get a lot of turnover. To I started a direct-to-consumer cocktail business.
Yeah,
I saw. Boxtails.
Yeah.
Bootstrapped. I'll never do it again.
How come?
But it was extremely fun. Various reasons. Firstly, to build a consumer product, I think you have to be really enthused about the product. To be honest with you, I saw an opportunity in the market. I went after it. I'm not a cocktail connoisseur. I did kind of obviously get into the world, but it just didn't really enthuse me that much. Mm-hmm. And I would not like to deal with alcohol again, because there was also stories behind that.
Keep hinting at all these fun stories.
There's a lot of stories. And I know we haven't got enough time to cover it. So yeah.
Give us some juicy tidbits at least while we're here.
We had a lot of alcohol under bond. So about £80,000 worth of alcohol under bond. Our manufacturer went bust.
Oh, no.
So for those that don't know what bond is, basically you're suspending paying duty. So if you go into Tesco and buy a litre of vodka, that litre of vodka might cost you £20, but actually £17 of that is duty.
Wow.
So that bottle of vodka only actually costs £3. So what you do when you have something in bond is you don't pay the duty until it leaves that warehouse. Mm. So basically until it was produced, essentially.
I think I learned that from Gary Vee, actually, with his wine business before.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Rings a bell.
Although there are slightly different rules for different ABV alcohols, mm-hmm. but potentially, yeah.
Yeah.
And basically what happened was we had all of this alcohol sitting there. So you own it, but you don't own it, is basically the scenario, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I had this bootstrap business, and then what had happened is I had too much alcohol for the cash we had in our bank, and the manufacturer went bust. When the manufacturer goes bust, then the assets will get frozen very swiftly. So I had to move extremely quickly, but I didn't have enough money in the bank to get that alcohol out.
Jesus.
So, and that was prior to a Christmas period, which, you know, was most of our trading. So it was an incredibly interesting time, basically trying to pull rabbits out of hat.
It's like lots classic of money around Christmas time as well. Like, you just cannot make that shit up.
No.
We've kind of very kind of quick whistle stop tour some of your adventures. I think just one of the things that's left with me before we move on too quickly is that turnaround situation, just kind of rewinding a few steps there. When you were 20, you just made me wonder how much of that really high pressure situation intimidates you versus motivates you. yeah, that. Because like some people, it's like, you know, bring it on, rise to the challenge. But it sounds like a lot. So, you know, where does that motivation come from for you?
Well, I mean, there was no other option because the business was nearly under, and you know, I have a relentless desire to, you know, never fail. And
it's funny you say there's no other option though, because correct me if I'm wrong. You said you're an early employee of that first business.
Yeah, but then very quickly I was a shareholder. Okay. So that is a long story, and there's a lot of water under a very short period of time bridge.
Okay.
But yes, you know, I wore my heart on the sleeve. It was, to all intents and purposes, my business. After a few weeks and months, and you never want to see anything you're involved with fail. Mm. And I think I've always had a chip on my shoulder, no matter what I've done in my life, to make sure that I succeed.
So. Yeah, yeah. Where do you think that comes from?
Bit of like broken home. I don't know.
Bit of a therapy.
Yeah, probably.
Self-reflection.
Yeah, this is a bit of a therapy section. I think I don't know, to be honest with you, but it's always been there.
Mm.
I can assure you of that. I think that. You know, anyone that knows me will always say, you know, I have a very particular will to succeed. Mm. And sometimes, you know, previously that's been to my detriment for maybe having tunnel vision, which you have to learn a little bit as you grow up, you run businesses, you kind of have to take this helicopter more macro view rather than just like, I'm going to break down every wall that's in my way. Mm. But yeah, I've always had a very keen desire to succeed.
Yeah, okay. Interesting. I mean, it sounds like it's just something that's naturally kind of within you. It's just kind of part of your DNA, your makeup. Obviously, you always had the entrepreneurial ambitions anyway. Mm. So, yeah, sounds amazing. So I can only imagine how busy you are. We were talking before about kind of busy days. What, I guess, how do you sift out the noise? Like, I can only imagine the amount of, like, messages, text, emails, cool, all the rest of it that comes your way, especially, like, now you've been through so much and angel investing and everything else. Do you have like a practical way of managing with all that inflow? Is there a bit of a checklist, or do you just wait until someone's tried enough times to get your attention? Like,
it depends. Like, I think over time you start realizing what's priority and what isn't, just quite naturally. My job revolves around people, you know, whether it's one of our portfolio co's, whether it's one of, you know, our businesses internally, like our investors, everything will always involve around interactions with people. And so I suppose twofold. Firstly, you have to know when to, you know, spend time on certain factors. But secondly, people will make you very aware when your time is needed in certain places. But it's you know, it's not easy. And, you know, work-life balance has always been quite a significant struggle, I'm not going to lie, for me.
What's an area of your life that has had to give way with work coming first? Like personal fitness, yeah. Like health, like.
I hope my wife's not looking naked. I think over the years, you just, you learn how to, you know, spend quality time in the right way. You know, Mondays to Fridays are, you know, quite full on. But yeah. I definitely switch off now in the weekends far more than I ever did. But my health has suffered immeasurably. I'm going to be really honest with you. And the reason why I decided not to, you know, thrust myself into starting another business is I get bad eczema and it flares up, and you know, it's very difficult to control, anyone that knows about eczema. So you know, there are definitely elements of my lifestyle that have affected my work-life balance and my health.
Yeah, but, that makes sense. Is there anything else that you do to help achieve that balance? You say switching off at the weekends. And then
get a fluffy dog
to cuddle up to every
good,
now and
he's
then.
He's a good boy.
That's nice. That's nice.
Got a little cockapoo called Rory.
Oh, cute.
But no, I think just you know, when you are thrust into certain positions at a pretty young age, and your life moves extremely quickly, and you're doing a lot of different things, I think you actually get a lot of perspective a lot more quickly, and. The main bit of perspective I've got is, you know, if you asked me 10 years ago, what do I want to achieve? I would have said to you, I want to take over the world. And if you ask me now, it's just, I want to have a happy and healthy life. And
getting old, Rich.
I am. I know I don't look it, apparently. But,
you definitely don't look it.
I feel it sometimes. but no, I think just life changes, right? Your wants and desires out of life. You had Nick on the conversation. I'm sure he would have said something quite similar, which is, you know, we're forever in this rat race. And then I think sometimes you have to properly establish what you actually want out of your work life and how that impacts your personal life.
It is easy to get sucked in, isn't it? And just get on with the day to day without even really lifting your head up and thinking until actually either something happens to you or you just have that eureka moment to be like, wait, I'm just, you know, it's another Monday, it's another week. What actually am I working towards here?
Why am I doing it?
Yeah.
You know? And like, you know, I think a lot of this, and this is a piece of advice that I give a lot of our portfolio founders, is like, stop living for tomorrow and start thinking about today. You know, like, we get so engrossed and entrenched in our difficulties, whether in our personal life or our work life. It's my job now to help give people perspective.
Nice.
But I can only do that because I've managed to get a bit of perspective myself. By the way, I'm not all the way there.
You've gained it through lived experience.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, interesting. All right, well, lovely segue into the angel investing then. So is that, again, just a fact check? Have you invested in 20 companies?
Probably
about
more,
that?
Probably more.
More now, okay.
Yeah, so I mean, there's two types of investment that I make. So one is personal angel investments, and then the other is through Founders Capital.
Okay.
So Founders Capital is a group of founders, operators turned investors that myself and my business partner Hugo have built over the last couple of years. And we have invested as a group into 17 companies. Now, in each of those 17 companies, either Hugo or I will take a stake in those as well when we push them to our community and invest in them. So between Founders Capital and my own personal angel investments, is probably about 35 businesses.
And how do you distinguish between what makes a good fit for your personal angel investment versus via Founders Capital?
Well, my personal is more passion. I think that, you know, I like consumer brands. And there are businesses that I am really passionate about that I think might not be perfect for our Founders Capital audience for different reasons. You know, traditionally SaaS and tech and traction is the type of businesses that we'll look for with founders capital, because it's a little bit more scalable, a little bit more reliable from a kind of shareholder perspective. Whereas personally, you know, there's a lot of different investments in my personal portfolio that I've done because I really back the individual. I haven't done much due diligence on the business or the sector, but, you know, I think the founder is absolutely brilliant, and actually I just want to chuck them a check. Or just be around them,
yeah,
you know.
Amazing.
So there's definitely a little less science in my personal angel investments than there is in Founders Capital, which obviously, because we're working on behalf of other investors with Founders Capital, it has to go through quite a lot of a rigorous DD process.
Yeah. What tips can you share with any founders who might be listening to this, who are fundraising at the moment, whether it's through the personal angels or Founders Capital? I know you've already said with your personal investment thesis is... Do I like the founder? Do I?
Yeah, well, not just, obviously. Yeah, sure. You know, like, you know, would I back the founder to succeed is basically the scenario, you know?
So, like, what? Okay, so let's stick with that for a second. Yeah. So, like, what characteristics?
Given I get asked this a lot.
I bet you do.
Yeah. I think, I'm sure you do. And my answer is always the same. It's twofold. It's tenacity and humility. If a founder has got a really tenacious attitude and, you know, just ready to go, and, you know, figure out how to succeed, and then on the other side, they can also admit what they don't know. I think that's crucially important. Mm. You know, there's no like one man island with founders. Like, they have to surround themselves with people that can help them forward their business.
Yeah.
And humility is one of the key traits that I believe sets the best founders in our portfolio apart. Basically.
Amazing.
So that's the advice I'd give.
Amazing. Yeah. And do those tips sort of differ if it's through the Founders Capital lens? Is it slightly different companies?
Well, no, a good founder is a good founder. And actually, that's one thing that doesn't change. We have a methodology where we look for, through Founders Capital, we look for what is an epic founder. And they have to get over that hurdle before we even look at the business. And we look at the market and we look at certain things. And actually, that's the same in my personal angel investments as it is for Founders Capital. Like, initially, you're looking at the individual in question.
Yeah.
But it's just whatever comes after that that might
sense.
Be less in my personal.
Totally. Well, especially when you think about all of the huge pivots that have happened and, you know, the top tech companies that we know today definitely didn't start out with what they were intending to build. You know, Instagram's classic example.
Like, and you ask for advice, right? I think that's a key part of advice for founders today, which is you probably won't build what you set out to build.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
And you will pivot. You might pivot 3 or 4 times, and that's okay. As long as you are able to understand what your customers really need rather than having blinkers. And also just... you know, recognize that markets change and they shift, and, you know, you have to react sometimes to what your competitors do. But conversely, don't keep changing.
Quick one. This is Future Steph coming to you from beyond. If you're enjoying this episode, then you can probably guess what I want you to do. Please do me one tiny favor that costs you nothing and takes a second of your time. Hit that subscribe button. It really helps to support this show. And I'm really grateful for you listening. Let's get back into it. Yeah. That ability to change your mind, I think, is something that's so powerful and maybe doesn't get spoken about quite as much as it should be. I think just societally, whether this is more of like a British thing or in the wider startup ecosystem, like it is okay to change your mind. And I guess that's where the humility and tenacity like really come in. Because as you say, it's like, well, you're going to come across new information, markets change, you'll uncover new insights. If you don't change based on that new information, it makes even less sense. But I think so many people are like, they're either in love with that initial idea that they've come up with, or I think there's a sense of pressure, especially with like building in public and communities and groups, all these other people, that it's maybe seen as a failure if they have to change or pivot.
Yeah, and look, obviously with first-time founders, you know, sometimes they have an idea of what perfect looks like. Second, third time they get, you know. And reality is, building a business, nothing is ever perfect. And the sooner you realise that, the better. And it goes back to the original point around gaining perspective. And a lot of my job is to speak to founders and try to get them to recognise they're in the trenches. And just try to lift them up and say, take that helicopter view, 24 hours, don't think about the micro, think about the macro. Mm. And it you see the weight when it's lifted, when they recognise actually the problems that they're dealing with or the decisions that they're making. They always think that every decision they make, when you're in the trenches, you think every decision you make is such an important decision. Mm. The reality is only 1 in 100 decisions you're making, or probably even more, is actually a business crit decision. But when you're so entrenched in the business and the day-to-day and your customers, you think everything you're doing, you know, has a complete knock-on effect when it actually doesn't. Mm. And so many decisions are reversible. Mm. The key thing is keep making decisions and moving forward. Don't procrastinate for too long and hamper your progress.
I love that. Rich, I wish I had your voice in my ear a year or two ago. And if you'd said exactly that to me, I would have been like, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, the thing is, I wouldn't have said that a year or two ago. That's the point. And I think that's, you know, a key thing here, which is like, we've all been there. You know, we've all run businesses. Founders run businesses. They do it on a day to day. I just have a lens, which is like, I'm seeing loads of different businesses and loads of different founders, and I'm seeing them all, you know, get overcome by their own personal challenges in their own businesses. And actually, they just need to recognize that actually, if you take a helicopter, a macro view, things aren't as bad as they often seem.
I was going to ask you about your decision-making framework, actually. So I love that you say, actually, like, most things are reversible. How do you make decisions, bearing in mind, like, again, I can only imagine the amount of decisions you have to make on a daily basis, whether big or small. Are there, like, consistent core values? Are there guiding principles? Is it just that kind of, you know, through your lived experience that you're able to be like, yes to this, no to that? Or is there anything more practical that you go to?
Well, I don't use any frameworks. Like, yeah. I don't, you know, write it down. Or I think maybe when I was running the businesses, there were a couple of instances where I was too quick.
Okay.
And I think you do, over time, recognise the decisions you just need to sleep on a bit. But for me, you know, I like getting other people's opinion and really understanding flaws, and it depends on what you're making a decision on, right? And you know, the more experience you have, the more easy it is to make gut decisions. But there's a lot of time when you know, just evaluating the decision for, you know, 24 hours is probably worthwhile. Mm. There's a lot of times where maybe I was making very flippant decisions when I was younger.
But it's so rare to hear that, isn't it? Because like, speed is such a magic ingredient to startup success. So it is rare to hear someone
and
be
like,
oh, I'm too
fast. And
it's also
in the DNA of nearly every entrepreneur.
Yeah.
You know, like, every entrepreneur wants to move at 100 miles an hour.
Right.
And, you know, I'm not saying they shouldn't. I am just saying that, you know, you always have a bit more time than you actually think you do. And, you know, sleeping on something for 24 hours is probably not a bad thing.
Makes sense. So you mentioned that there was a couple of things where you were too quick on to make a decision earlier on in your career. Is there anything else that you now, with all this lived experience, that you can't shortcut, right? You've been through what you've gone through. Is there anything that you'd go back to maybe 20-year-old Rich and give some of that sage advice that's from that helicopter view?
Maybe take more time to hire.
Yeah, interesting.
I mean, ironically, you know, there's a lot of books and kind of research out there to say, you know, you should take a lot of time to hire and less time to fire. And actually, I've probably hired too quickly and fired too slowly previously. Again, you only really learn that over time. And I think with hiring, it's really interesting. I think, especially in this current landscape, right, when founders go to raise their pre-seed or seed, whatever, and they have that next tranche of money, the easy decision for them to make is, I'm going to hire the next rung of talent. So, you know, if I had manager level previously, maybe I need a head of, that's going to help me. Or, you know, I need directors around me because the business is more established. A lot of the time, they're making those decisions wrongly, and actually, that I made that mistake as well. Like, a couple of times when I was running my businesses, I realised that I'd hired teams that I thought would take us to the next level, but actually they just made our business a lot more slow, or they brought in experiences that actually weren't right, and I had talent in the business that I should have nurtured up. There's an easy kind of, as soon as money's through the door, the easy decision is to hire more senior. Mm. And actually, that's not always the best way to do it. Mm. And I have learned that the hard way a couple of times as well.
It is so tricky though, because I've seen either firsthand with my own experiences or through other founders that I know that, you know, if it's kind of too junior, they can be more of a hindrance than a help. And I totally get your point as well with, you know, I've definitely seen some people bring in kind of the Rolls Royce, people with all the logos on their CV and the great experience, but it's still...
And they spend most of the time on the golf course.
Yeah, like, or strategizing.
Yeah, okay. Or strategizing, that's the big one.
Yeah, exactly.
Strategy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, right, thanks.
It reminds me, have you heard of the story of Monzo's first marketing hire?
I haven't.
It was exactly that. It was they hired someone who just on paper was like, amazing, and obviously it felt fantastic for Tom Bloomfield to be like, oh, this is so cool, we can hire this amazing caliber of talent. But it was just like, you know, hiring a Rolls Royce to pop down to Sainsbury's for a pint of milk, you know. And they had somebody that was junior at the time who was maybe doing, you know, a bit of everything, maybe had like the customer success manager, general dog's body type of role, but nurtured this guy, and he became the first like proper head of marketing who I think then stayed with the business for like years and years. So it's, some of it is recurring themes. Some of it, I think if you've got someone who's a bit more junior, it's recognizing the potential. Are there any sort of practical tips that you can give, again, in your experience of hiring, kind of what to look out for, any red flags?
Well, I mean, it's cliche, but like, you know, speak to people that know the individuals, you know, especially in the startup ecosystem, like it's quite a small world. And there's always someone that knows someone, and you'll get a good gauge if you have a couple of conversations with people. So I think spend time to ask questions and critically evaluate whether you've got happy ears. You know, so a lot of the time when you're hiring or in sales as well, you know, there is a tendency for people, certainly founder types, to hear what they want to hear.
I was just thinking exactly that.
Mm. And you know, if you've got a board of advisors, or you've got people like me or angel investors in and around the business, maybe involve them in the process to make sure that you are making the right decision, you are hearing the right things.
Mm.
Because different people with different perspectives will come at it from different ways. And then here comes back to the humility piece. If there is feedback about said individual, you
listen
know, heed
it.
It and listen to it.
Yeah.
Right? And it's still your decision at the end of the day if you're a founder. But yeah, I would definitely, you know, involve as many of your trusted people, especially if it's a key hire, you know. Founders shouldn't be taking that responsibility on their shoulders, because, you know, one school of thought is, well, it's my business and, you know, it's my decision, which it is. But you definitely need to get other people's opinions and make sure that you haven't just got those happy ears.
I think when it is dealing with people, it's so much harder to be objective, isn't it? So getting those other perspectives to help balance out your view, I definitely, and I'm sure I'm a victim of this as well, where, you know, you were saying before about being a people person, and it's all to do with networks and contacts and stuff. And the amount of times you think, oh, I just love this person, like the vibes are there, we connected, we get on, like, oh, this is amazing. But trying to get past that bias is, as you say, where the humility comes in, having different perspectives. Just on that note, with other perspectives, boards, have you ever had a board? Do you have a board at the moment? Where do you kind of, what's your experience with having advisors around you to help?
Yeah, I mean, I've always had boards. I think every founder that raises any amount of capital should have a board and be held, you know, accountable in some way, shape or form. They can take different guises. And, you know, the way that you assemble them will depend on the business and the industry. But you need people that you trust to keep you honest. But they are also bought into the vision and mission of the business. And an early stage businesses shouldn't have, you know, board members stroke investors that are, you know, taking too much money out to sit on the board either, because they need to have a vested interest in the business being successful. So it varies. And the other thing is the most value I've ever had in kind of businesses, or any of the businesses I'm involved with now, is there are informal board structures that exist that, you know, people might not be formally sitting on your board or, you know, have a formal role, but they play a very key role in helping you steer the strategic direction of your business.
Would that be more like a mentor? Is that what you mean? Or...
Yeah, or not even like that. You know, it's like someone, you know, someone that has got an experience that you can lean on, and that different people have different experiences, you know, and you shouldn't ever look to, you know, have one mentor or have one other board member, because you need a collection of thoughts and backgrounds and experiences to help you deal with whatever's thrown your way.
Yeah.
Like there are, you know, a plethora of different things that you're going to come up against as a founder.
Yeah.
And it's not a one size fits all. And that is a piece of advice I give to founders is if you are assembling a board and you maybe have one lead VC and they go, right, well, the board is just us two. Like, that's a bit pointless, you know. Always try to get a different opinion in there as well, especially if that VC have got a vested interest. I've seen a couple of occasions where, naming no names, there are a couple of VCs that sit on these very early stage boards and have too much of a say, and the, you know, they have almost, they're actually making the wrong decisions for founders because they've never even been a founder themselves, but the founder feel obliged to listen to them because they've committed a chunk of capital to their business. That also could be quite bad as well. So I think if you're assembling a team and a board, whether it's formal or informal, the important thing is get people from different backgrounds, people that you trust and have a vested interest in the business being successful, and you know, make sure it's set up in the right way.
Yeah, great advice. Thanks for that, Rich. Appreciate that. On the kind of idea of assembling that kitchen cabinet of having a variety of perspectives to help shape your decision-making process and how you go about things, there's that saying, which is, you know, you're the average of, was it like five people that you spend most of your time around. If we apply that same idea to kind of media, whether it's books, podcasts, TV, document, whatever, are there, can you name any kind of five other sort of types of media that shape who you are at the moment, where you go for inspiration or resources, or are you just too busy? World domination, Monday to Friday.
It's not world domination anymore. It's not. It's like, you know, be happy and healthy. But I think the most value I get in my life is not from reading resources online. It's by experiencing and being with individuals. Like, my value is the relationships I build, the phone book of contacts that I've got to help any business out of any issue. And I think that for me personally, I'm not so enthused about, you know, doing shed tons of research online to get to an outcome. What I'd much rather do is be in a room with a group of people that I respect and admire. And also be able to call people when I, as and when I need them to get their advice, whether it's legal, operational, logistics, whatever.
So typically, I ask kind of the same closing question on the show, but I'm going to rejig the order and going to go with this one first. So the philosophy behind the show, Strategy and Tragedy, is that often the biggest mistakes or tragedies teach us an unforgettable lesson. What's one big tragedy, so to speak, that you haven't already touched on that's taught you a big lesson you'd like to share with our listeners?
Always, if you are ever acquiring a business, make sure that you do proper due diligence before you acquire that business. So the lesson there is, if it looks too good to be true, it probably is. The lesson was, we purchased a business, we needed to do it extremely quickly, and then subsequently I realised that actually I didn't do any of the due diligence that I needed to do, and it cost us a lot of money to deal with after we'd acquired this business. So anyone that knows about M&A will know businesses in distress can be good value sometimes, but they also come with a lot of kinks that you need to consider. Now, when you're time pressured, the DD process sometimes goes out the window. The tragedy was I made a decision to buy a business that I should never have done.
Right. Okay. Thanks for sharing that. I'm sort of taking away two key things from that as well. I think just doing your due diligence on either side of the table. Obviously, you were from the acquisition perspective, but I've sort of heard that from, you know, angel investors, founders, you know, do your DD, it pays off. And I've definitely experienced when I feel the time pressure, often it's, is it really real? And actually, you need that time. And if it needs to be done, like, now, it's not a deal.
If your gut feels like, actually, it's not right,
Listen to it.
Yeah. And I think that's what I didn't do in this circumstance, where I knew there were things that we were skirting around the edges and I knew they could come and bite me on the arse, but I didn't do anything about it.
Yeah.
And I think that my heart overruled my head in that regard, and that probably wasn't fantastic. So I'm a firm believer that we all have pretty significant spidey senses. It's just how we
totally
we kind of acknowledge them. Yeah. And I think that you should always trust to a degree your gut instinct.
Yeah.
And again, take the helicopter view and make sure that you've not omitted anything, you know, crazy before making, because that M&A is the type of example of where you should take a lot of time making a decision.
Yeah, makes complete sense. And I wholeheartedly agree with you on that. A little fun fact, did you know that during fetal development, our guts are actually shot through with tons of neurons, like neural cells. So if we are feeling something that's a bit iffy, like there's a reason for it.
Oh, I did know that. I did know that, yes.
Backtracking now, are you? Yeah.
I heard that the other day, And that's where the gut, that's where
exactly.
the term
like it's
gut
for a
feel
reason.
Came from.
Yeah, it's like the second brain. Like there's a reason, something's, there's a reason for it. So I totally believe, totally with you on that. The reason why I didn't want to do that as a closing question is because I want to do a plug next. So can you fill us in on what you're doing at the moment? Obviously we talked about Founders Capital. You were telling me before about some other ventures. Mm. So Mike, over to you. What are you up to at the moment?
Yeah, so we spent the last couple of years building a pretty extensive founders community. And over the next few years, we're going to be building that out further. Our overriding feeling is that there's a few things that aren't quite right in the incubator and accelerator world. And we believe there's a bit of a gap in the market for a proposition that serves founders without them having to go through an incubator or an accelerator. Because there's a lot of the time, and I'm not saying all of them, but a lot of the time they don't provide enough value for founders, and they kind of get they get kind of like persuaded to join, but actually the value isn't, the payoff is not there. So what we are building is a group of founders for individuals to learn from their peers. So that's founders that have been there, done it, and exited, and there's founders that are aspiring to kind of, you know, start their first venture. And basically around these communities, we're building a series of businesses around four key pillars. So these four key pillars are pillars that we've identified that founders need to enable them to start and scale their businesses. So firstly is capital, founders capital, talent. So who have you got in the business? Who are you surrounding yourself with? And then it's legal. So, you know, legal support to start and scale your business. And then finally, it's marketing. You know, how are you building a personal brand and your business brand? Obviously, we both come from marketing backgrounds, so save the best to last. But, so over what people should expect from us is, you know, firstly, if you're a founder or aspiring founder, you know, take a look at what we've got going on with Founders Capital or Founders Club, and that will evolve over the next couple of years. We would like to help and support as many founders as we possibly can start, scale, and hopefully get them to sale.
Wonderful. It sounds amazing, Rich. It makes total sense. I love what you're doing. Final question I am leaving for last now is any quick tips that you want to give founders that we haven't already covered? Because I know it's been a very fast.
This has been a whistle stop.
It's been so far. I feel I always wish I had like 3 hours. I might do, if I do like a new season, then I'm gonna do like Joe Rogan style and get like 3 hours to go deep with my guests.
I feel sorry for your listeners because they're gonna be like, what the hell is going on here? He's gone from marketing.
Sandy Balls,
turnaround, Jonathan Ross. Then he's gone to cocktails, alcohol, angel investing. in the space of 30 minutes.
I love it. I'm here for it. Exactly. I know. We're trying to pack a lot in. So yeah, any quick tips, any advice that you haven't, you've been so great. You've already shared some like awesome tips, but I just wanted to, because I've got endless questions. So if there isn't anything that I haven't already asked you that you feel like, oh, I wish I could have said that, then now's your chance.
I think for me, you know, the key, you know, and your listeners, I'm sure it's a broad array, right? So, you know, we come from brand building background, but also, you know, I mainly am entrenched with working with founders, right? And as we discussed previously, the key things for me when I work with founders are how tenacious are they to kind of do what they need to do to build their business and win, and then additionally, humility. So I think, you know, if you've got those two things, you shouldn't need many other tips. But if you do, you know, I think, like We've covered so many different things.
I don't know. All right, that's fine. We can leave it there. No problem at all. Rich, thank you so much for coming on the show. I know that you're incredibly busy, so I'm really, really grateful for your valuable time sat here with me now. I'm definitely left wanting a lot more. I wish we could continue this for many more hours, but thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
No worries.
And thank you so, so much for listening. Please join in for next time. The episodes are weekly, so tune in and hopefully see you there. Thanks a lot.